Please stand by. Good day, everyone, and thank you so much for your patience. We'd like to welcome you to today's IBM Event Publishing conference call. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. Now, at this time, for opening remarks and introductions, I'd like to turn the conference over to Diane McCollum. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Hello, and welcome to our sixth DB2 Tools teleconference of 2005, Event Publishing, what it is and what can it do for you. Today, we are privileged to have Paul Ketteret, lead architect for WebSphere II Classic Federation and WebSphere II Event Publisher, as our speaker. And now I'd like to turn it over to Paul. Paul?
Thank you, Diane. Good morning, everyone. As Diane mentioned, that we're going to be talking about event publishing today. What is it and what can it do for you? You should all be looking at slide number one or page number one. I'll refer to them as pages as we go forward with the title Event Publishing, What Is It and What Can It Do for You? You could please turn to page two, and this page should be titled The Agenda. In order to illustrate the usefulness of event publishing and give you a few examples of how you can use it in your customer environments, we've come up with a few hypothetical problem domains or solution domains, depending on your perspective, that we're going to go over. And these are marked down the agenda here as replication, synchronization, and event monitoring. We'll go over some problem descriptions, some existing methods of solving those problems, and then we're also going to go over a few step-by-step descriptions of how we enable event publishing. And in this case, we're going to segue off of the first solution, which is replication, and talk there, and then go on to our synchronization and event monitoring discussions. At the end, we'll wrap up with a what, why, and how description or summary of event publishing, and we'll be all through. So if we can now go to page three. Replication, synchronization, event monitoring. These are essentially three very common problems that are encountered in most customer environments that can be solved with event publishing, as well as other methods. We're going to talk about some alternative solutions for each of those problem domains, some of their characteristics, such as the pushing and pulling and latency, and et cetera, some of the other characteristics, asynchronicity, synchronicity, et cetera. And then we're going to show you how our suite of event publishing products can be used to solve these problems. The event publishing products that we currently are fielding right now and that we'll be talking about in particular on this presentation are WebSphere Information Integrator Event Publisher for ZOS, which captures mostly non-relational sources, IMS, VSIM, IDMS, etc. DB2 Event Publisher, which captures DB2 events. DB2 queue replication, which is actually a packaged end-to-end replication product, which we'll be talking about in the replication domain specifically. And KIX Business Event Publisher, which captures both KIX transaction events as well as KIX data events. If you go on to page four. For the purpose of the discussion, I'm going to offer a definition of replication. And mostly this is just to distinguish replication from the other, from synchronization and from event monitoring. And I don't mean this to be the textbook definition, but it's for the purposes of this presentation. Replication in our presentation involves the synchronization of two like databases. And what I mean by that is that there's a database source and a database target, and there's minimal transformations, if any at all, between the source and the target. Typically, these type of solutions are called mirrors out in the field. And another common implementation, just for as a point of reference, is web catalogs, where there's a back office database and a front end database that's enabled on the web in order for easy access by web applications. These databases are usually on different platforms, so they don't have to be. But they're typically on database on ZOS, Wintel AX, Solaris, HP, Linux, etc. But the source and the target may be on different databases, and they're typically on different database management systems. So, for instance, the back-end database might be on DB2 for ZOS. The front-end database might be on SQL Server, to give you an example. But again, they can be on the same database management system. If we turn to page 6, customer ways of solving replication scenarios today generally involve a few tried and true methods. One of the most common one of the most common requests we hear is for two-phase commit type applications or products. Now, a two-phase commit is a kind of de facto description of products that allow you to update two different databases in the same transaction. These are extremely tightly coupled. This is an extremely tightly coupled solution with zero latency. And let me define zero latency in this case. The delta between updating the source and the target database is near zero because both of them are updated in the exact same transaction. And so in that sense, they are an ideal solution for replication. Some of the drawbacks for two-phase commit is that in order to implement this solution, you have to hold cross-system locks, not only cross-system in terms of the two database management systems in question, but this could be cross-platform if the two database management systems are on different platforms, which can be very expensive from a resource point of view and time-consuming in itself. And that causes a drag on the original or the source database management system itself. This DBMS impact could be also felt by the applications themselves since the source transaction is actually delayed by the attempt to update both databases in the same transaction. The advantage, however, is if the transaction fails, then the transaction fails on both database systems at the same time, so there's no out-of-sync conditions in a two-phase commit solution. Probably the more common problem with implementing two-phase commit on site is the lack of products that can accomplish that. The next bullet item you see, staged replication. This is probably, or ETL as it's loosely referred to in the field, this is probably the most common method of implementing replication. Not necessarily the most desired, but the most common. It's very loosely coupled. Typically, there's a fairly high latency, or a delta, if you will, between the source and the target databases. Essentially, what happens is a combination of ETL tools are used to basically do full loads, typically, of the source of the target database from the source database one or two times a day. These can be implemented via multiple batch jobs, although those batch jobs can be automated. And the most frequent problem with this is stale data, obviously, because of the latency between the source and the target databases can be very long. If you increase if you decrease the latency by increasing the number of times you essentially refresh the data, then the load on the source and target databases increases, and you have an impact from that as well. Event publishing, which is the solution that we're going to talk about today, is loosely coupled in the sense it's asynchronous in the very same sense as ETL. The difference is this is an incremental update where there's an initial load with event publishing, and then you have updates to the target database when changes in data occur to the source database system. So essentially, it only pushes out changes as they occur, as opposed to refreshing the entire data source over the course of the day. This low latency typically results in, it's typically around the area of seconds or minutes, actually sub-second in a lot of cases. It's dynamic and adaptive in the sense that you don't have to essentially run a series of jobs every time. This is a product that continually pushes this information out to the applications that are hooking into the target database. And it's adaptive in the sense that event publishing does not demand a particular application architecture on the other side. In other words, it can be used for replication as well as synchronization as well as event monitoring, et cetera. And as I said earlier, it's asynchronous as opposed to the synchronous two-phase commit scenario. So it has many of the better characteristics of stage replication ETL as well as two-phase commit. If we go to page 6, I mentioned earlier in the presentation that we actually have a packaged replication product as well. In order to help differentiate the difference here, event publishing is a generic solution where essentially we have identify source database systems for which we will publish changes to those data, and publish them in general means that we're putting them in some common form, in our case XML, in some common repository for being picked up by a mid-tier tool product or a customer application. So, for instance, it's on a queue somewhere where you can pick these changes up as they occur, or you can be triggered to pick them up as they occur and then apply them to the target database. Package replication, which is our DB2 replication product, is an end-to-end product that has a configurable source as well as apply side to it that you can install, and there is no user-written or third-party middle-tier tool or application that you have to enable there. You essentially define the sources you want to capture, and you define the targets that you want to apply these changes to. The reason we're also talking about event publishing in this particular problem domain is the fact that queue replication currently supports primarily relational database systems as source and targets, although we do have it in plan to add the non-relational database sources and targets to replication as we move forward in IBM. And I want to stress that Event Publisher does provide some additional capabilities that you might consider, even if you are doing a package replication scenario. Event Publisher provides the basics for replication, which is the capturing of data as it occurs in real time, the normalization of that data to a single normal form. So if you have multiple source databases and non-relational, relational, et cetera, you can read these changes as if they're coming from a single database. It provides a delivery mechanism for pickup by distributed applications and tools. And it can be connected with other transformational and workflow-type products such as DataStage, Event Broker, WebSphere, Application Server, etc. But most importantly, it can be used for other scenarios in addition to replication, such as synchronization and event monitoring, which we're going to be talking about later in the presentation. And finally, it can coexist with the replication product, so it isn't, in that sense, it isn't an exclusive choice. But if you do have relational sources and relational targets, DB2Q replication is an ideal choice, and your problem primarily is replication, then DB2Q replication is an ideal choice. All right, page 7, we see here a replication scenario. We're going to go over a few scenarios for each problem domain. And in this particular case, this is actually based on a customer environment, but it's a fairly common problem in that you have a series of back-end databases where the data on those IMS, VSAM, and DB2 in this particular case, but they could be any database systems, have different applications, in this case claims, policy management, and billing across those database systems. Now we want to get that data, we want to take that data and apply it to a data mart down in the off platform. And at the data mart we want to apply analytical solutions or analytical processing against that, and not to mention be able to process it from the web or from the internet. And now typically today what happens is that a series of COBOL extract applications, either homegrown or purchased, are used to pull the data on a staged basis, and then an FTP job is used to FTP them out to the warehouse solution out on the web. Now the problem is that as you know, in most of your sites, the batch windows are shrinking. And these large data pools can essentially extend those batch windows, which is an unacceptable solution. So if we go to page 8, we show the same replication scenario using event publishing. Now, essentially, all we've done in this situation is we've automated the capture and distribution of the changes And as you can see here, we're actually still using a portion of the ETL solution to do the final transformations to the data mart. That's absolutely optional. These can be homegrown applications that pull it off of the queue and apply it directly to the data mart, or we can use a workflow product such as Business Integrator to apply it to the data mart, or some of the data marts can hook directly to these queues and pull this information down. But the primary advantage we have is that there's no homegrown applications on the back-end side, on the ZOS side, that you have to maintain or schedule or monitor their successful execution. Essentially, you have a product that's dynamically capturing this data in real time and publishing it out in a normal form out to the MQ for consumption by any application. It's reliable and recoverable. These publishers have the ability to recover in case of failure as well. If we go to page 9, I mentioned earlier we're going to segue a little bit to go through an example of how we set up an event publishing situation. And in this particular case, this example is going to involve, quite naturally, my products, which are the non-relational event publisher products. And this is just to give you an idea of the steps necessary in order to enable event publishing. How do I, for instance, determine, or how do I signal what data tables or data elements in the back end that I'm going to capture, and what happens to them at that point? So, Event Publisher for ZOS, we have a three-step process for turning on event publishing for a particular data element. It's discover, map, and populate. I'm going to go through all three of those steps. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about apply side choices. And I'm going to show you a sample Java QReader program that reads these changes for the non-relational as well as the relational sources off of the ZOS queues or off of the distributed queues. And we'll talk a little bit about the mid-tier product enablement, what tools you can use to consume them on the other side and ease the burden of the application programming. Page 10, common metadata mapping. Essentially, with the non-relational event publishing products, I mentioned earlier that there was a common form that they're going to be on the wire. Well, the first thing, since we're capturing from multiple disparate sources, in this case, say, for instance, DB2, IDMS, IMS, vSAM, we have to map those different native schemas into a common relational schema and store them in our own metadata catalog. Now, this mapping does two things. It not only gives us the normalized relational data model, but it also identifies to the product what tables you want to capture. So if we go on to slide 10, this is a high-level overview of the workflow that has to take place. Essentially, what you do is you collect the native schema, whether it's copybook, DBDs, or IDMS. And again, I'm going to be talking primarily about the non-relational product in this case. And then you import those into a GUI tool called the Data Mapper. And from that GUI tool, we essentially project those native schemas into a relational schema, and the output of that is a DDL that we call the use grammar. And then that use grammar is applied using utility program against our common metadata catalog on the event publisher product on the host. Page 12, this is just describing a few terms as we go through here. I apologize for the arrows here. I'm not trying to illustrate the term source here. I think those were left over from before. But we talk about a logical table. Our logical table is just the relational mapping of the non-relational file. And we'll be talking about DBMS types in here, such as an IMS logical table. So I'm talking about DBMS loosely. And then finally, the data source is used to talk and should not be confused with the CLI JDBC or ODBC data source. We're again talking about the source or native database system itself. Data Mapper runs on Windows currently and uses a toolbar. Actually, we have in plan a dynamic version of the Data Mapper that we're going to use that will dynamically discover and update these catalogs. So currently this is a staged approach. Go to page 13. You can see here this is just a graphical depiction of what I've already talked about. On the left you have the native schemas, and on the right you have the use grammar, which is the generated DDL. On page 14, this is what the data mapper screens look like. The standard Windows application. Go on to page 15. The first thing that has to take place in the mapping process is discovery and collection. Now, what I mean by this is that someone has to go out and find the copybooks, someone has to go out and find the DVDs, the schemas, the sub-schemas, et cetera, and get them to the data mapper in order for us to map these tables. Typically, the person that's doing this is the DBA. And then once that, since the DBA typically knows where these schemas, sub-schemas reside, they know what the native data model is, and ultimately they'll be responsible for knowing what the relational mapping of that data model is. Page 16. So once the DBA identifies the target database file, where the source definitions are, and where the COBOL copybooks are, they bring it down to the workstation where the data mapper is installed, and they decide which of these they need to project, and they project them. Using the data mapper, page 17, it's a standard Windows application. The first thing you do is you create a repository once the data mapper is brought up, and you create a data catalog. These are strictly internal entities, and not to be confused with the catalog that we're going to populate at the end. We have an owner, and we load the source definitions. We create a table. Now, when you start the data mapper and you pull in the, for instance, COBOL copybook, if it's a VSAM data set, we auto-project from the source reference into a table. Most of this is automatic. There's very few manipulations required after the fact. However, you can review and tailor the column definition. You can do things like define indices and keys. And you can also do some, we do a kind of a native or default mapping of the native data types to SQL data types. You do have some flexibility in some of those cases to go to different types. But essentially, this process is primarily automatic generation. And when you're finally done and you're happy with the column names, et cetera, and you have no other changes, you essentially just push a button and it generates the DDL. Page 18, you should see this slide with a title, which shows a GUI screen with the title Import Copybook. Now you see in this particular case where we've created a table called Test. This is the relational table that we're defining. And we're importing this particular copybook, which you can see down there in the view screen, into using it as a way to define the columns within the table test. You can see we can select whether or not there's group level data items. You can handle occurs clauses by either flattening them out or creating record arrays from occurs clauses. And you have some other options here, including if you have a record exit, what that record exit name is, so you can have custom handling of or custom processing of that particular table. And some of the guidelines in page 19 of COBOL copybook. I mentioned that importing COBOL copybooks, I mentioned that it's sort of more or less an automatic generation from the COBOL copybook into the table. There are some things that you want to look out for, which is what we consider complex objects, which is redefined when there's multiple occurs clauses or occurs clauses. And you just have to be mindful here that you have to determine how you're going to handle these situations. Like, again, with occurs, whether or not you're going to use a single row with all of the dependents in that row, or whether you're going to basically project it as a record array where there's a separate row for each dependent. Redefines typically are managed by defining multiple tables, one for each definition, if you will. And the other thing to keep in mind is if you're doing a lot of this mapping, is that you can create a reference table which you can reuse for the next mapping operation. Page 20. As I said earlier, columns are automatically created. How are they automatically created? They essentially use the COBOL copybook definition to create them. There's kind of a default mapping between the native data type and the picture clauses or the picture clauses and the SQL data type. There's actually a kind of an offset length kind of mapping that you can also view, and this is visible in the DDL. We don't store the remarks from the copybook. And some of these functions are DBMS specific. So obviously, if you have like IDMS data where you have paths that you have to map and stuff, there is some specifics when you're doing this projection for depending on the native DBMS you're dealing with. Page 21 shows a screenshot. Now, in this case, this is the column dialog box. We see here the COBOL name at the top, which is CL day of the week, and the element name as well. You see the default mapping of that data type as char 1, and you see a field here where null is and a field for conversion exit. I'm going to describe those for a second. Some of the DBMSs we map from have the have the capability to define nullness or define a null indicator automatically, which allows us to just convert that over to the typical null is descriptor that you find in relational areas or relational database systems. Some don't. In those cases, we allow you the ability to define a data value that can be considered null. And so the null is field would be used for those DBMSs that don't support nullness in the source DBMS. And so you could say that the null is for this particular column, if the column is nullable, is, for instance, on a numeric 0. Or it could be some other field, fox or something. So we automatically carry over the null indicator from DBMSs that support it. If they don't support it, you have to define what null is if it's required by application. Field conversion exit. Like we have a record exit, which is essentially handled, a row-by-row situation for a table, we can also define field exits for doing particular manipulations at the column level. Page 22. These are the common data types. The most common data types are the char, the decimal, small int, and integer. These are SQL data types. And we also support some of the more exotic data types as well. Varchar, long varchar, graphic, var graphic. Graphic is usually DBCS-like information. And on page 23, we can see some of the common mappings, where on the left would be essentially the SQL data type, on the right would be the COBOL described data type. And that's somewhat self-explanatory. All right, now that we've done our projection, we're on slide or page 24, and say we have not had any additional manipulation to do, the only thing we have to do now is generate the DDL, and this is essentially a file generate, select pulldown file, and then click generate, and essentially the use statement, so the DDL is saved to disk, or we can automatically FTP it to the ZOS system where the catalog resides. You also have a view window in the data mapper to view the generated DDL, and it is human readable. It's fairly descriptive, like I said earlier. It's like row offset type descriptions, and it has some of the source names in there. So it's, in fact, some of our customers actually manipulate or generate the DDL manually as well. And on finally, the final step in the process, loading the system catalogs on page 25, is you just feed the DDL into our utility that updates the metadata catalog. Now, when you've done this, once this is done, this entire mapping process, we have a lot of slides here depicting the mapping process, but it's actually a fairly automatic process. And in terms of customer implementations, The mapping of the tables generally takes a few hours, and on most sites, and most of that is discovering or collecting the information. Once the mapping, the actual mapping or projecting is pretty much automatically handled, and then you just update them in the catalog. Now, the effect of all this is once the event publisher product comes up, if it sees a relational table in its catalog, then it knows that that table and the corresponding native data elements that that table represents are marked for capture. And the event publisher product then enables an agent in the native DBMS stream that looks for those native data elements. Let's say, you know, let's make it simple in the case of VSAM. It's actually looking for changes in the stream to that VSAM data set. When it sees a change occur, and when I mean change, I mean the logical update, insert, delete, commit, or rollback that involve that data element, it packages those changes and converts them into a common XML relational form and then publishes them out on an MQ series queue. That is the event publisher suite of products for DB2 and all the non-relational sources. On page 26, I mentioned that earlier that you can, the event publisher basically publishes these on this queues for general consumption. Now, something has to consume them, these change messages. Typically, the customers in this case would write apps that would read these XML-based messages from the queue and apply them to the target database systems if in a replication or synchronization environment, or do some transformation on them for event monitoring environments. Also, we have other products such as WBI Event Broker, Data Stage, as well as other mid-tier applications with workflow models that can consume these changes off of the MQ series queues and give you a more non-manual method of applying those to some target application. But for the illustration purposes here, I've included a sample Java Queue Reader program to give you an idea of what it takes to read these things off of even a ZOS queue. For those of you not familiar with MQ series, even though we're depositing these changes on a ZOS-based MQ series queue, a simple Java application can be used to read them off of that queue in the distributed environment. And the JMS classes provided by IBM allow you, due to the TCP/IP connection to the COS platform, and pull this change information or these messages off of the COS queue. You could alternatively have a more complex MQ configuration setup where you have multiple queue managers, and so the ZOS queue manager feeds the ZOS queue manager, or I mean a Unix queue manager, for instance, and then you can do a local reader. But this sample Java queue reader I'm depicting here in slide 26 actually, in this particular case, is running on the distributed side and directly accessing the queue on the ZOS side. As you can see here, you can show this queue reader in one page. And this is, for those of you not familiar with Java, essentially most of this is setup work where you're just identifying the queue manager and you're connecting. The heart of the program in this particular case is the GET. And you can see that under the comment GET message, where we go out and retrieve the message, the read string, and then essentially I'm just closing up. We're doing no processing of the message other than a print line of the message here. But this is where you would take the message and then probably use an XML parser to unwrap it and then apply it. Like, for instance, in most cases, this would be the creation of insert, update, or delete statements to the target database. Again, we have products that can be used in conjunction with Event Publisher to automate or to give you workflow kind of application design environments to make this an easier step. But you certainly have the ability to read these things directly off the queue. Page 27. Well, our little segue is done, and now we're back to one of the second problem domain, in this case, what's commonly referred to as synchronization, and again, this is a definition for the purpose of this presentation, mostly to distinguish it from application. Synchronization involves the synchronization of two or more unlike databases. Now, in this particular case, we may be talking about many transformations. The data model on one side may look nothing like the data model on the other side. We may be talking about aggregation, where you have, for instance, multiple source tables going to a single target table, or vice versa. You may be involving multiple products. You know, there's additional cleansing and transformational transactional products. And more importantly, it may not be a DBMS on the other side, or you may be involving a combination of a DBMS and a transactional environment like Kix or some other product out there. Again, obviously, these databases and other products are usually on different platforms and usually implemented on different DBMS systems. Page 28, solutions for synchronization. Well, you could use two-phase commit, but you can only use it for some of the subcomponents in the synchronization scenario. And the problem with using two-phase commit is that two-phase commit would also have to take into account the different data models as well. So it cannot be a comprehensive solution in this environment, and it still suffers some of the original problems we talked about with regard to cross-system locks and performance overhead back up at the replication stage. You can use a staged replication, and again, this would only apply to the subcomponents that are DBMS specific. A lot of customers do homegrown applications. Obviously, those are resource intensive and custom, and can be not adaptive depending on how they're written. You can use federation products, one of which is I'm also responsible for federation product as well. This is typically a pull type product as opposed to the push, where you occasionally pull this information down to a local platform and then apply all of the techniques to get it to the target DBMSs or target transaction systems. Or you can use event publishing. Again, event publishing also provides aggregation like the federation product does, but it has the advantage of it being a push technology where these changes can be applied not on a pull basis but on an as-they-change basis. It's loosely coupled and asynchronous. It's asynchronous from the target, from the source database, and it can be asynchronous from the target database as well. And it allows for triggered operation, and I use the triggers in quotes here. This is not to be confused with database triggers, which are part of the original transaction. Event publishing products typically are asynchronous monitors that pull this information out of the original transaction, but observing the transactional boundaries of the original transaction. So in other words, they don't vote. They're not involved in the locks in the original transaction. But again, it provides a push capability, and it's asynchronous. So we feel that it's an ideal solution for synchronization. On page 29, I'm going to go through a series of examples of integration solutions. Now, in this case, you can see something that was fairly similar to the first scenario for replication. In this case, we have vSAM, IDMS, and IMS databases on the back end, very similar type applications updating them, claims, billing, and policy management. A very similar method for pulling this information currently, which is using a series of COBOL, custom written COBOL extract applications. However, you can see on the target side, it's a dissimilar application. We've got a self-service website up in the Solaris box, and we've got an integrated voice response system running on the NT box. So this is not necessarily a one-for-one replication scenario where we're updating somebody's database. We have some transformation that has to take place on the right-hand side, and we have some redirection, if you will, or fan-out that has to take place on the right-hand side. Now, the problem with the COBOL extract applications or the homegrown solution is that it's very costly. It's not only to write but to maintain, and involves many man-hours of essentially ZOS skill sets. And then you also have to have the distributed skill sets to apply them against the two different synchronized systems here. If we go to page 30, We can see where we've inserted our event publisher, into this scenario. Now, again, on the left-hand side, what we've done is we've eliminated most of the ZOS skill sets required to implement the solution, which greatly reduces the cost. It's a packaged product, so there isn't, and it's a flexible product. Event publisher can be used for many solutions on the right-hand side, but it does provide the basics, which is to capture these data changes as they occur and incrementally feed them into these MQ series queues for consumption by applications on the right-hand side. Now, you still have developer resources required on the right-hand side to apply them to the two discrete systems. But now we're talking about Java skills or C skills on the distributed side, which are so it's essentially reduce your cost in implementing the end-to-end solution. Next slide or next page is page 31. This is an order processing example. Again, this is using kind of an extract approach to go to publishing this data out to a e-commerce site. And there's, as you can see, there's additional transformations taking place here. And the e-commerce site is running on Solaris. And it says on there to integrate the CICS transactions. But I think that might be a mistake there. I apologize for that. But essentially, the same situation is in place on the left-hand side is that you have to involve mainframe skills in order to do the extracts, in order to maintain those stage replications on an orderly basis. And then the right-hand side, you apply those to the specific site with the additional transformations that makes this a synchronization scenario, which is applying it to this e-commerce site, basically it's a website. And on page 32, we show event publisher in this scenario. What we've done is we've eliminated the ZOS skill sets required on the left-hand side and giving you a non-staged, real-time update of these changes out to the right-hand side. Or the target side. On page 33, we're getting a little more exotic here. Now we're showing, this is not a before and after image, we're actually involving event publisher right off the bat here, but this is a synchronization example, and now we're synchronizing between a CRM system, a Siebel system, and an SAP, which means we're probably, and in this case we're using one of our other products called WebSphere Business Integrator, and its capabilities, workflow, and fan-out capabilities to apply these to these two different databases. Now, in this scenario, we're probably creating load data sets for SAP and so that SAP can occasionally pull these load data sets into its environment because it tends not to want to be dynamically updated. And it's probably a dynamic update in the Siebel example, but that's totally at the discretion of the customer. But you can see here where this feed, this event publisher feed, is ultimately feeding two completely different systems on the right-hand side. Page 34, well, we show a variation on the CRM example. In this case, we're using WebSphere Integrator to directly update. Now, it doesn't show in this picture, but these changes are coming, in this particular case, from a non-relational database on the left-hand side. And in this case, you see the WebSphere Business Integrator is updating a local table on the right-hand side, which is actually Oracle in this case, and updating another non-relational database using one of our other products, which is Federation product, to access it. Over on the left-hand side, you see the little hierarchical tree over the database. That's what that's attempting to depict there. And also we're fanning out and using stored procedures to generate DB2 distributed on a table up on the right. And the only point of this is a fairly complex synchronization scenario. But again, we're using the same feed in all of these cases, which is Event Publisher. Event monitoring, page 35. Now, we've talked about replication, and we've talked about synchronization. And now we're going to talk about something a little bit more out of the box. Rather than the synchronization of unlike databases or the replication of like databases, And synchronization even does have some additional capabilities, which is to go to like transactional systems. Event monitoring involves the processing of discrete events. And what I mean by this is that we're now listening for a change to a data element on the source database system, but we're going to do some other type of processing. It can be as simple as notifying us when, for instance, an inventory count goes low, or it can be something where we set thresholds so that we do some additional math on the application that's consuming the events to determine if a particular threshold has been breached. We can implement counters where we can, and aggregates where we can take a series of data changes to elements, and based on all those changes and using a rules engine, we can then apply those against some new transaction on the other side. So this event monitoring often is used in conjunction with products that provides that provide or are enabled by rules and actions. But essentially what we're doing is we're monitoring these events, and they can be very, very discrete data change events as opposed to pulling or replicating or mirroring entire tables from one end to the other. For instance, and again, these events, the databases that we're monitoring obviously are on the source platform, and the events that we're applying them against, we mentioned database management systems and transaction managers, but they can also be events that end up calling, you know, alerting your cell phone, you know, dialing your cell phone to say that a particular stock symbol or stock limit has been breached, or they can be applied against a completely different type of application. If we go to page 36, event monitors typically are implemented using today using database-specific triggers. Most of the major database systems allow you to write triggers off of the original transactions, and then you can write a program that does something based on these triggers. The problem with that, of course, is that your solution for the event monitoring is actually part of the original transaction, which slows down the original database system itself. There are exits where you can capture this information as well, and that's obviously a labor-intensive solution, similar to triggers. There's the EAI approach, where essentially you insert hooks into the source applications updating the data, and then usually typically go these EAI hooks route to a centralized hub approach where you have maps for messages, you know, from these various applications where you can discern and pull out the information necessary to implement your event monitoring. And finally, we have event publishing, where rather than centralized, there's a decentralized source architecture that's concerned primarily with the data as opposed to any particular application event. And it while it can monitor on a transactional basis, that is, it maintains the transactional semantics of what changes to what data or in a particular transaction, typically in event monitoring, that's not really a requirement. That's a transactional basis, is more of a requirement in a replication or synchronization scenario where your transaction semantics may have to be moved from source to target. In a pure event monitoring, you're more interested in the discrete changes themselves. If we go on to page 37, we show an event monitoring scenario. And this is a scenario where essentially the customer has coded a series of hooks in their application programs. And these applications are the return, the order processing, and the payment applications, all updating IMS. And they're feeding one of our other products, WebSphere Business Integrator, actually, that's being used to update or notify the credit analyst portal in this particular case. So we're actually using one of our products in this traditional EAI integration, but the main point here is that you have to create hooks in all of these native applications and feed them into this other application. Obviously, creating a hook for each process can be extremely labor-intensive, and you also have scenarios where you might not have the original source for the application or the original programmer for the application, so it can be difficult to do. There are EAI products that can capture these changes if these are network-based applications, but in a lot of cases they're not, or they can provide hooks for some of the more common application environments, but nevertheless, it can be kind of a messy scenario. Now, page 38, we show event monitoring to solve the same problem. Again, what we've done here is we've removed the hooks from the application, so we're not dependent on changes to the applications. We don't have to worry about reestablishing the hooks every time there's any development change to the application. We don't have to worry about hooking what might be hundreds of applications. Or, you know, even if they're three or four, you know, that can be a pain. The point here is that event publishing works on the data. It doesn't matter how many applications are updating the data. It only cares when the data changes. So it's kind of a decentralized approach, but it's also a single source of change that we capture. Now, in this case, we're still using WebSphere Business Integrator as our application design tool environment, but we're simply feeding it directly using the Event Publisher. So it's kind of a dynamic update to the Business Integrator, and we've reduced the number of ZOS skills and ZOS maintenance issues on the left-hand side again. Page 39, this is a slide that I pretty much threw in here for fun here. This is one of the demos that we do when we're traveling out to the various conferences and stuff. And the point of this slide is to show the customers that, you know, we can start thinking out of the box. Now that we know that we can dynamically capture changes to discrete data elements, it starts getting people to think outside of the normal problem domains of replication, synchronization, and even event monitoring as to what you could do with a product like this. And that's the only reason I'm including it here. We basically manufactured an application in this case, which is the stock checker, which is where you can put in your cell phone number into this website and say that you're interested in a particular stock, and you give a high or low watermark here. You can see that on the stock monitor up in the top box, and say, and then this is in order for you to know when you want to buy or sell the stock. It's a very simple application. And we implement this using WebSphere MQ for ZOS and our Event Publisher. We actually use our other product, Classic Federation, in this case to update the stock price, but that's not the point of this slide. The point of the slide is that we have some sort of database system where stock prices are maintained or monitored, and we have the Event Publisher that publishes these changes out to an application that, when it sees the change has exceeded the high or low water mark, it then actually calls the cell phone of the person that's registered for this stock change and alerts them to either buy or sell. It's just a simple kind of demo, but it kind of illustrates the type of thinking that you can start doing when you have a product like the Event Publisher, which is essentially, you know, like notification-type applications where you can call beepers, call cell phones, or do some other kind of non-database update type of application once you receive these change records. In the summary, we're going to go over what data event publishing is, you know, why and how. So we go first with the what data event publishing. Data event publishing is the ability to capture changes to native database elements and essentially deliver them in a common form to either custom-written applications or other packaged applications. In fact, you can use this. You don't have to use this in lieu of EAI or ETL tools, for instance. You can augment EAI or ETL tools if necessary, or you can go directly to workflow tools or to custom-written applications and process these changes. Why would someone, and this is page 41, why would someone use data event publishing? Well, we talked about some of the reasons in the previous slides in this presentation, but you can drive downstream applications or APIs based on these events. The main thing that I mentioned in some of the scenarios is you could reduce application development maintenance, especially on the ZOS side. And you can reduce the performance impact to both the source applications, and I would also stress the source DB messes themselves, since the event publishing is an asynchronous monitor. They can be used to meet auditing requirements or event notification, like we talked about, and you can also integrate with BI tools, warehouse tools, as well as portals. Page 42. It facilitates business integration. Essentially, the name of the game here is integrating these different database systems and these different database systems and the platforms they're on, these different data models, and these different types of applications. Data event publishing is one tool you can use in your tool belt, so to speak, that kind of normalizes some of this information so that it can be used by a variety of different types of applications on the right-hand side. This normalization, in our case, again, is an XML, common XML form with an XSD to describe it, but it's basically the XML in question describes relational rows and columns, no matter what the original database format is. And then how you apply these row and column change events is totally up to the discretion of the customer. It's application architecture agnostic in that sense. In this particular case, I was talking about I'm the classic lead architect, so my focus is not necessarily on the DB2 event publisher or some of the other products like Business Event Publisher from Kix, but on the classic, which is the non-relational capture. So this is specific to that product. But it shows you, again, here, very simple. On the bottom, you see essentially the native database sources, and those changes are captured in change agents and essentially published out onto WebSphere, MQ, and XML form over the top. And over on the left-hand side, we enable the native data amounts we want to capture by simply including them as a table in our metadata catalog. And the final slide just shows a larger picture of the two classic products, which is the event publishing product on the left-hand side, and our classic federation product, which is an access product on the right-hand side, and one possible mid-tier product, which is Data Stage. Data Stage provides transformational capabilities out in the space. But this is just to show as an example. This could be WBI Event Broker. This could be WAS. There could be any mid-tier product, including a customer-written application. I want to thank you for listening to this presentation today. This was the intent of this presentation, again, was just to show you a few typical problem scenarios that you might have or might need to solve in your particular customer environment, and how event publishing can be used kind of an out-of-the-box way to solve these in a dynamic, asynchronous fashion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Great job. And now we'd like to open it up for questions.
Thank you. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone. Now, for those of you joining us on speakerphones, please remember to turn off your mute function before signaling for a question. Once again, that is star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment. We have one question coming from Jose Gutierrez.
Hi, Jose Gutierrez from IBM. Paul, I have a question. Can we use this as a solution for a customer that is looking in some way have two machines having low balancing and replicate the data if something happens in one machine, like a high availability scenario?
Yes. In those scenarios, high availability type scenarios, you typically have some sort of mirror environment where you can, and you need these two mirrors to be synchronized in order for, or I guess you could say replicated, in order to have multiple ways of accessing the same data. Is that essentially what you're talking about, Jose?
Yeah, in fact, what they want to have is to have those database synchronized. So if something happens to one database, the operational database, they can redirect to the other database.
Yes, right, exactly. Yes, you can use this for that. Essentially, you set up the event publishing from the main or source database system. And after an initial load is done to essentially synchronize the two database systems, Event Publishing would dynamically, in real time, update the mirror database, if you will, or the backup database, if you will, depending on what your terminology is, and make sure that the delta between that database and the source database is minimal. And since the Event Publishing works in second, sub-second time frame, your delta from the point of failure of the first database would be minimal with respect to you continuing processing on the second database, the failover database.
And I can make it both ways, so those two databases can be in load balancing. So if something impact to database A, that replicate to B, and if something impact to database C, replicate to A. Can be both ways, or it has to be one way?
Well, event publishing is essentially a one-way product. You can implement, obviously, you can implement an event publisher on both sides, and do the two-way replication is essentially what you're doing. But the only thing I'd caution you there on is that you have to take into consideration, some of the problems of two-way replication is obviously you can get a scenario where you could a change replicated to one database could continue and be in a continuous loop going back and forth because it's monitoring every change at the source side. So in those two cases, you would probably have a centralized application that would be the that would receive the changes from both database systems and determine whether or not, you know, take care of the mirroring problem or take care of the some of the other problems associated with two-way replication. What I might stress in those environments is our GB2Q replication product solves those problems. It's a packaged product that also, in addition to being enabled for change capture, it also solves the problem of two-way replication. I don't know what databases you're talking about, but if they're relational on both sides, you could use the DB2Q replication product.
Okay, thank you.
What are the, were the databases non-relational?
They are going to be two DB2 machines.
Okay, in that case, I would recommend using the DB2Q replication product between the two databases.
Okay, thank you.
With one question remaining, please press star 1 if you do have a question. Going next from Fidelity National Finance, we have Linwood Fleming.
Yes, I have a question. In your examples, you show that doing the replication from a ZOS to other platforms. Can you go both ways? In other words, if we had an application that we're rewriting in a client-server environment that currently exists in a ZOS environment, and I wanted to keep the data in sync on both sides, could I use this product to keep it in sync on both sides?
Well, you'd need to use, first of all, the event publishers we're talking about is we have a set of event publishers. I mentioned there was a DB2 event publisher which actually handles relational sources. So I guess, first of all, I'd ask, what would be the distributed source database we're talking about?
That would be SQL, could be
SQL Server or Oracle, typically.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you would have to use probably our DB2 event publisher, even in spite of the name, it actually captures from other sources as well, but essentially they're relational sources on the distributed side. Now, in order to apply the changes, now on the target side, what would you be applying these changes against?
On a DB2.
Okay. Now, if it's DB2, and this is replication, again, I would probably recommend the DB2Q replication end-to-end package product.
And it could also be vSAM as well.
No. Now, that's where the hitch comes in. We're not currently enabled. We have that in plan. I mean, we're planning on doing that. I should say we have requirements for doing that. But we're not currently enabled with vSAM as a target yet, okay? So in that case, you might want to use the DB2, you might want to back off to the DB2 Q event publisher, which would capture the sources on the native database systems. And then to apply them against your vSAM data set, you have a couple of choices here. You can obviously write your own programs that do that, and there's certainly some connectors in WebSphere application server for updating vSAM data sets, or you can write your own programs. We also have that other product that listed on the title slide that I'm responsible for called the Classic Federation product. And I'll just describe that one briefly so you understand what it is. It's a DBMS that runs in ZOS. Looks a lot like DB2 from a client perspective. So you have JDBC drivers and ODBC drivers to access it. Mm-hmm. But instead of its own data stores, its data stores are actually vSAM, IMS, IDMS, database, Datacom, et cetera. So you could write your application that consumes the change event from the DB2Q replication product off of Oracle SQL Server. Your application can simply then create a JDBC or ODBC update statement that would go to our server and it would update the vSAM data set directly. So you could treat the problem from a development point of view as a relational database problem, so you don't have to worry about writing custom vSAM code. That would be what I'd recommend in that case, because that, you know, then your developer skill sets can be purely relational.
Okay.
And distributed.
Okay.
Mr. Fleming, did you have anything further?
No.
Thank you. Let's move on now to Jim Rohal with Huntington National Bank.
Hey, Paul. We have a situation. We have two data models in DB2, and our thought was to use triggers and stored procedures to keep the two data models in sync until we switch to the other. But it sounds like, and we do own DataStage, it sounds like we can use this product through DataStage to do the transformation to keep the models in sync. To use DataStage, do you need the WebSphere piece? Is that the connecting piece to DataStage, or can I talk directly to DataStage from the event publisher?
You know, in this case, since it's DB2, we're talking about the DB2 event publisher as opposed to the event publishers that I deal with primarily, which are the non-relational event publishers. But I don't know what their state is currently with integrating with DataStage directly. I suspect, Jim, that what you'd have to currently do is read the changes off the queue and feed them into the DataStage product at this point. But I'm not the best reference in that case. And if I could, let me see if I could take your email address. I could have the DB2 event publisher queue rep folks contact you if that's okay.
That would be great.
Okay.
Ready?
Yeah.
Jim.Rohal, R-O-H-A-L. At Huntington.com.
And you have DataStage?
We have DataStage.
And you have two different DB2, different data models.
Two different data models. We're going to eventually migrate to the second model, but in the interim we're going to keep the two in sync until everything is written to use the second model.
Okay. And okay. I will have someone contact you on that, Jim. I will let them know right after this presentation is done.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And we have no further questions at this time, Ms. McCollum. I'd like to turn the conference back over to you for additional or closing remarks.
Okay, I'd like to thank Paul for a great presentation today, and I'd like to also thank you, our audience, for attending and participating in this teleconference. We look forward to seeing you again at future teleconferences. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That does conclude today's conference call. Thank you for your participation.